Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, welcome back to Reliable Sources. I'm Brian Stelter. There are so many stories we could lead with right now, like President Trump's odd relationship with Vladimir Putin, calling him fine at a recent rally, or Trump's legal team stalling for time, becoming even more combative with special counsel Robert Mueller. Or how about the end of Scott Pruitt's time at the EPA? All the cablers had to create scrolls to show all of Pruitt's scandals. Whistleblowers and reporters ended up exposing Pruitt's abuses of power, showing the true power of the Fourth Estate to hold officials accountable. And that's also what the press has been doing when it comes to the border and Trump's border separation policy. Right now, roughly 3,000 children, we don't know exactly how many, but we know 100 of them are under the age of five, are still being held separately from their parents at facilities both in the Southwest and in Texas and in other parts of the U.S. When will they be reunited with their parents? These are simple questions that are still not being answered. In fact, the Trump administration is asking for more time to fulfill court-imposed deadlines. Right now, all children under five are supposed to be back with their parents by Tuesday. All the rest from ages 5 to 18 should be reunited by July 26th. Of course, every day is painful for these children and their parents. And these deadlines are helping keep this story in the center of the national news spotlight. There have been moments where I've thought it was fading away, where people were forgetting about the consequences of this policy. But then it continues to come back and get back in the news headlines. I'd like to explore how that's working and how local reporters, reporters at the border, are continuing to lead the way, demanding answers. Because after all, that is how this story first broke through. It was reporting from places like the Houston Chronicle, you see here from last November, that uncovered the administration beginning to try out a policy involving separating kids and parents at the border. So let's get into it with three reporters who are at the proverbial front lines covering this story as it develops. Loemi Creel is an immigration reporter with the Houston Chronicle, whose story I just mentioned. Rafael Carranza is a border reporter for the Arizona Republic and La Voz. And joining me via Skype is Nina Satija, an investigative reporter who works for both Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and for the Texas Tribune. I appreciate you all being here. Loemi, let me start with you, because your stories about what was going on last year were a preview. They were a foreshadowing of what was to come. Tell us about how you first knew the Trump administration was separating more families last year.
Right. So the attorney general last spring ordered federal prosecutors to ramp up the prosecution of immigration crimes, including illegal entry, which is a misdemeanor punishable by a few days in prison. But that crime already makes up more than half of the federal dockets in the Southern and Western District of Texas. So I knew that this could have a big impact and started asking federal public defenders what they were seeing. And they reported suddenly having dozens of parents as clients asking them for help to find their children. This was unusual because typically parents traveling with children weren't prosecuted for the misdemeanor, but they were kept together while they pursued their civil immigration cases.
Right, right. And now we fast forward more than 6 months. Nina, what information are we getting from the government about the status of these children?
Well, we're not getting a ton of information. As has been reported, a federal judge in San Diego has ordered that all children separated from their parents who are under the age of five be reunited with them by Tuesday. Of course, the government has expressed some skepticism as to whether that can happen, and I think certainly we in the media feel the same way. It's hard to imagine that all of these toddlers are going to be reunited with their parents by Tuesday. And then those over the age of five, there's a couple more weeks, I believe, for them to make, for the government to make that deadline of reunification. But we don't have a lot of information. We don't know if the government's been able to match up all of parents with all of the children that have been separated from them. We know there's DNA testing going on. We're tracking one family where, you know, the grandmother has been living in the U.S. for a long time, has been trying to get custody of the kids, has sent documents after documents after documents to the shelter where they're at in Arizona. No response. Now the mother, who was actually separated from the kids at the border, is being asked to send the same documents in order to prove that she is, in fact, their mom. So it's just it's really a chaos.
And you're there in Port Aransas near the border. How frustrating is it for you personally as you're trying to cover this story?
It's very frustrating. You know, in fact, a couple weeks ago, you know, I think it's been two weeks or so since the Department of Homeland Security has put out an official news release on its site that really digs into this question of how parents are going to be reunified with their children. And at the time, they'd said that the Port Isabel Detention Center in Port Isabel, Texas, is going to be the site for reunification. Well, it's hard to imagine that that's the case because this is a detention center for adults, in fact, mostly for men. Women can be held there, but it's primarily a detention center for men. So everyone started to wonder how on earth could this be the site for reunification of children with their families when it's not even a place to hold children. And then, you know, Department of Homeland Security altered its statement slightly and said this is just going to be the main site for where parents of these children are going to be held or potentially deported. So we've really just gotten no answers about how this reunification is going to take place, where it might take place. Now we've heard, I think, on during Friday's court hearing that parents are going to be transported to where the children are. But again, no specifics as to the logistics of how this is going to happen.
And Rafael, what about you? You're in Phoenix. You're on the Arizona side of this story. I feel like we've heard a little less about that than we have in Texas, where there's been a lot of news coverage. What stories are you hearing there from Arizona?
Yeah, and I think Arizona plays a critical role in this part because I think now that the separations have kind of, you know, moved away from the border in a way, like at least from what the government says, they'd stopped them for now. But these kids are now being held in facilities all around the country. But Arizona in particular is one of the states where, you know, many of these facilities are located. So many of the high profile cases that we've seen in the past few weeks, you've had a lot of the parents who were held in immigration detention centers here in Arizona and a lot of the kids who were held in facilities over here as well. And so it's been a challenge for us to try to track where these facilities are located, how many kids are there, because a lot of these facilities hold not just the kids who were separated from their parents as well, but also unaccompanied minors who arrived to the border on their own. And so it's been a challenge to try to get a number of how many of those kids are here. And then
It's not just that we don't have access to the facilities, and I get it, there are real privacy concerns, but we're not seeing inside. In some cases, we don't even know how many detention centers there are or where these kids are being held. We don't even know where to go to stand outside.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that, you know, whenever some of these facilities are, you know, are discovered or, you know, we find out the location of them, we talk to some of the neighbors who live nearby and they have no idea that that was even a facility where the kids are being held. But yeah, there's very little information on, you know, where these facilities are located. And since it's contracted to private companies, they don't have, you know, they're under no obligation to disclose where the facilities are.
And I get this is a very complicated story. There are government officials trying to do their best in a very bad situation. But, you know, it's the kind of thing that makes people so angry. I wonder, Loemi, how do you keep your emotions out of this since you've been covering this for months?
Well, I mean, I think that that's our job as reporters. We do that every day in any kind of context. And I mean, I think in this particular situation, though, it's just trying to speak to the parents and try to tell their stories. One of the stories I most recently wrote from Brownsville was a mom who had come here to ask for asylum after being raped by two police officers, and her four children were taken from her, including one she was breastfeeding. And I covered her court hearing in Port Isabel last week, where she was asking for asylum, and she told the judge that she was unable to accurately ask for asylum because she was so worried about her children. So, I mean, there's certainly a lot at stake here.
And Rafael, what about local coverage versus national? You know, I've been seeing a lot of the national coverage, but are local outlets emphasizing parts of this that maybe the national media is missing?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a lot of moving parts to this story, but one of the angles that I do think has received maybe a little less attention nationally is the fact that this zero tolerance policy that created some of these separations has had other effects on the border as well, and namely for asylum seekers who are heading to the ports of entry. As a result of this zero tolerance policy, which prosecuted entries illegally in between the ports, it essentially funneled people to go through the ports to be able to file their claims there. But we've been seeing and we've been reporting, very, very long lines at a lot of these ports from California all the way to South Texas, and even instances of people being turned away from the ports of entry. And so
Right.
there's really no clear explanation at this point of why this is taking place. If the administration has, publicly said that the people who do have claims should go to the ports of entry, but we've, seen waits of maybe up to like even a month at times, 2 or 3 weeks for some of these asylum seekers to talk to an immigration officer.
Thinking about what pictures people are seeing, there's been some pictures recently of some reunions. There was some video from Logan Airport in Boston of a reunion. Maybe we can show that. But I want to show it to make the point that that's the exception, not the rule. When we see pictures of reunions, this is not what's happening in most cases, right, Nina? This is rare right now. Most kids have not been reunited.
As far as we know, yes, that's correct. And I think a lot of these reunifications are certainly going to happen behind closed doors. And some of that's going to be at the request, of course, of the families themselves for privacy. But I think also
Right.
that it's been, the separations have happened behind closed doors as well. As someone, all of us, on this panel have been to the border, and I think we've had the frustration of not really being able to see much on the ground. Because the separations are happening inside these hieleras, these ICE boxes where folks are held right after crossing the border to be processed. Or they're happening as people are going into detention centers or as children are going into shelters. They're happening behind closed doors. It's very hard for us to see how all this is playing out.
Yeah, the pictures can actually be deceiving. The big story is that the U.S. government won't even tell us how many kids are being detained. They won't even tell us a number. And I think we have to keep the pressure on until we get an answer. Thank you to the three of you for being here. Thank you for all the work you're doing. Quick break here on Reliable Sources. And then President Trump's new communications chief. He's bringing a lot of baggage to the White House. Cover-up accusations and espouses racist Twitter feed. I want to show you the unprecedented relationship between Trump and his favorite news network right after this. Fox and Trump. Trump and Fox. You know they're close. But do you realize just how close? This kind of relationship has never existed between a U.S. president and a TV network. It is unprecedented. It's sort of a love story, so let me count the ways. First of all, the president loves Fox. He loves what he hears on Fox. He promotes the network and trashes its rivals, telling people when and where to tune in. A president has never endorsed a network like this before. Trump watches Fox and tweets about it and watches some more. Sometimes he hears valuable information, but other times he hears terrible misinformation. Sometimes he then spreads it in interviews on Fox. And around we go. Since becoming president, Trump has been interviewed on Fox every 20 days on average. Now, some of these are not really interviews at all. They're more like chats designed to promote his presidency. In this chat last week, Maria Bartiromo sounded like she was the president handing Trump talking points. Watch.
Well, you made a bold decision on Iran. I mean, this was incredible.
In Iran, look what's happening in Iran.
Look what's happening now. The strikes and the protests. The people
Iran's
want economic freedom.
Iran's a different place.
So let's take a closer look at this relationship. You can see how this back-scratching benefits both sides. Trump benefits from Fox's friendly segments and softball questions. And then Fox benefits from Trump's preferential treatment and constant promos. If you plug Trump, he might plug your book or your show, or he might attack your competitors, or he might do both.
You have been so great, and I'm very proud of you. And, I'm a ratings person. You notice I always talk. Okay. Has anyone seen his rating? What you are doing to your competition is incredible.
Thank
Number
you.
One, and I'm very proud of you.
Ah, yes, Sean Hannity. He defends Trump, bashes the media, turns a blind eye to Trump world scandals, and gives his guests free rein to call for the jailing of Trump's opponents. And that's just on the air. When Hannity's off the air, he gossips with Trump and gives advice about who to hire. So let's just underscore how weird this is. no TV host, has ever had this kind of relationship with a U.S. president before. And to take it a step further, no network has ever propped up a president quite like this before. Sure, Obama had big fans on MSNBC, but there wasn't this kind of constant coordination. No one ever thought Keith Olbermann was Obama's shadow chief of staff, but that's how some Trump advisors describe Hannity. This is new, and it's weird, and we shouldn't get used to it. There's been almost a merger between a culture war TV station and a culture war president. Now, it started as a mere acquaintance. Look at this. Fox and Friends gave Trump a weekly spot way back in 2011.
The Donald now makes his voice loud and clear every Monday on Fox.
My message is a better message than anybody else.
Trump got to know Fox's priorities, he got to know his base, and Fox got to know him. Now, fast forward 7 years. He's tweeted or retweeted about Fox more than 1,000 times. And he's become close to Fox Uber boss Rupert Murdoch, who was once harshly critical of Trump. The two men now talk weekly, sometimes daily, according to the Washington Post. Now, Rupert reportedly opposed AT&T's acquisition of Time Warner, CNN's parent company. Of course, Trump opposed it too. The DOJ even tried to kill the deal in court, but lost. So what happened when Rupert struck his own deal, a deal with Disney? Oh, a very different reaction. Trump called to tell him congrats, and the same DOJ lawyers decided to give it a thumbs up. The New York Times editorial board raised its eyebrows last week, saying, hey, this Disney-Fox deal sailed through a bit too easily. Now, the DOJ says every deal is different. But let's get back to Fox. What really makes this relationship unique and unprecedented is the feedback loop. Trump constantly gets ideas and talking points from Fox, and then when he holds rallies, he repeats those talking points, and Fox carries those rallies live from start to finish. It makes you wonder, what would Trump do without Fox? A president has never preferred talk shows over his own intel briefings before. A case in point from CNN's Oliver Darcy this week, a dubious Fox News story appeared to spark a new Trump attack on Obama. The Fox story was sourced to a hardline Iranian cleric, not a reliable source. And that was the network's news side doing it, not the opinion side. Fox does have reporters who try their best, but the network is defined by its cheerleaders, like Jesse Waters, who dined with Trump at the White House earlier this year and got an autograph, or his co-host on The Five, Kimberly Guilfoyle, who is dating the newly divorced Donald Trump Jr. Look, they seem to be a cute couple, and I love a good love story. But doesn't this radically affect her day job? How can any of her colleagues criticize Trump when the president's son's girlfriend is sitting right there at the table? Doesn't this complicate the entire network's coverage of the Trump family? I've got to ask. And speaking of quandaries, Lou Dobbs is called into Oval Office meetings so he could, quote, offer his 2 cents. Jeanine Pirro has talked to Trump about possible jobs. Pete Hegseth was rumored to be up for the VA secretary job. And Laura Ingraham was talked about as a possible press secretary. Now, they're arguably more valuable to Trump right where they are. But Trump has poached several others from Fox. Heather Nauert, Mercedes Schlapp, John Bolton, and more. And that brings us to Bill Shine. For 20 years, Shine was a super successful Fox News producer and a lieutenant of Roger Ailes. When Ailes was ousted amid sexual harassment scandals, Shine was promoted to co-president of Fox News. But he was credibly accused of covering up Ailes' misdeeds. He was named in multiple lawsuits. Shine denied all wrongdoing, but he left Fox under the cloud of scandal last year. That's when his friend Sean Hannity started lobbying to get him hired at the White House. And now, more than a year later, it's official. Shine is the deputy chief of staff for communications. I think we should ask, would any other White House have ever hired Shine? Now, I noticed the reporters started looking at Shine and his wife, zooming in on the Twitter feed belonging to Shine's wife, Darla, doing some of the vetting that maybe the White House didn't do. What the reporters found was shocking. As HuffPost described, Darla Shine has a long history of promoting anti-vaccination conspiracy theories. And as Mediaite reported, she posted years worth of racist tweets. Ugly, prejudicial stuff. I don't really want to read all of it, but you can see for yourself on Mediaite.com. Now, Darla deleted her Twitter account as soon as her husband was promoted. And now the man in charge of White House comms has gone silent. CNN has asked the White House for comment, but there hasn't been any. Now, surely they're not just going to lay low and wait for this to blow over, are they? Surely Fox News reporters will press the White House for comment, right? If they don't do that, if Fox ignores this story, it'll be another sign of the Fox-Trump merger. Now, quick break here on Reliable Sources. Coming up, how not to cover Trump's rallies. Vox's Ezra Klein has some strong words for cable news execs. But first, there's no shortage of hyperbole when it comes to coverage of Trump and the possible Supreme Court pick. We're going to try to sort through all of it with the legendary Nina Totenberg in just a moment. The Supreme Court is always shrouded in mystery. Justices rarely give interviews, and cameras are not allowed in the courtroom. All we get is delayed audio of oral arguments. And yet, for the last 10 days, the High Court has been front and center in the news because of what's about to happen. With Anthony Kennedy retiring, President Trump is set to announce his pick for a replacement, possibly one of these faces. Now, as of Saturday afternoon, Trump was still undecided, according to the New York Times. But he has decided to reveal a nominee Monday, 9 p.m. Eastern time. Sounds like something out of The Apprentice. The White House took the rare step of formally requesting airtime from the major networks, so we know it's going to happen. In fact, it's going to interrupt The Bachelorette on ABC. So let's talk about what happens next. Nina Totenberg is joining me. She's the legal affairs correspondent for NPR. Nina, you've been through more than a few of these. I was thinking back to last year. President Trump also made this a primetime event. He had a big reveal just a couple of weeks into his presidency. Mm-hmm. Does this feel like a repeat of that, or is Trump making it an even bigger event this time?
Well, the difference, I think, this time is that last time he pretty much outsourced it entirely to the Federalist Society. He was a brand new president when he had this pick, and he understood to some extent that he didn't really know this much about it. He wanted to satisfy his base, and he was allowing himself to some extent to be led. That's not happening this time. And he, as far as I can tell, he really hasn't made up his mind. They're hoping he's going to make up his mind tonight. They've got tonight. Four rollouts ready. And they, I've talked to sources. I can't tell you the Sean Hannity sources, but I do have sources who haven't slept in days. And because they can't tell what he's going to do. That's why they have four rollouts.
Makes me wonder if he shouldn't have said it's definitely going to happen Monday. Maybe he needs more time. That's okay.
It would be okay, but one has the sense that it wouldn't make a difference. We'd still be up against a deadline, and that he, like most of us, me too, you too, we all operate on deadlines.
Inspiration is the deadline, right?
Right. That's exactly right.
I saw you posted on Twitter when Kennedy announced his retirement to quote REM, "It's the end of the world as we know it." Now, I can't sing it. I won't even try. But there's been a lot of hyperbole, even hysteria on the left. How is it that this is the end of the world as we know it? And how do you try to not contribute to the sense of panic that liberals are expressing while at the same time trying to explain this is a big moment in America?
Well, it's very difficult because it gives conservatives and a brand of conservative that was unknown probably pretty much 25, 30 years ago. It gives them a lock on the court. And I'm not saying that every case will turn out. We will have surprises. There will be some cases that turn out not as one expects. And I don't think that the justices themselves are partisans, but they do have legal ideologies. And the people who are being seriously looked at here have the legal ideology of Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia. Scalia being considerably to the left of Justice Thomas. And that means that John Roberts, the Chief Justice, a firm conservative vote, who I think has voted with all the liberals and been the swing vote maybe five times in his tenure on the court since 2005, he will now be the, quote, swing man. Well, that's a pretty conservative swing man.
Yeah. And your job, how will it change at all in the next few months? What will you be most focused on?
Whether I get my vacation.
That's so honest. I love that.
What I'll be most focused on is the legal record and what we can tell from that legal record of the nominee. Because lower court judges are bound to follow Supreme Court precedent. And while they can veer considerably to the right or the left, and you can tell a lot from that, it still is, you're still reading tea leaves. The tea leaves amount to a lot, though. And you know, Republican White Houses, starting with Reagan, have taught us all that you can really pick somebody who will not provide a huge surprise. On the occasions when there have been been surprises, the principal one being David Souter, who was George H.W. Bush's pick, he was a surprise, but they also had a confirmation problem. So he was probably a wise choice for them at the time, and they were assuring the right, it'll be fine. Well, he was far more centrist or liberal, if you want, and they were furious.
So the tea leaf reading begins in earnest tomorrow.
Yeah, the tea leaf reading begins. It's already begun at the White House. So they think they've got four people who will be just fine, who will reflect their views on everything from guns to abortion to civil rights to discrimination to regulation. They think they've got that locked, and they probably do most of the time.
The battle for the soul of America plays out through this process. Nina, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you on the radio.
Thank you so much. I'll see you on the TV.
Up next here on Reliable Sources, Trump rallies. I bet you have an opinion about this. Are they eating up too much airtime? We'll talk with Vox's Ezra Klein in just a moment. President Trump has been holding more rallies lately, and Fox News has been airing them live. Usually CNN and MSNBC have not been, but his comments at rallies typically become big news afterwards. Criticizing John McCain and George H.W. Bush, mocking the Me Too movement, insulting Senator Warren's heritage. It's all newsworthy, right? Wrong, according to Vox editor-at-large Ezra Klein. He says we are giving these rallies way too much attention. I spoke with Amari earlier, and here's what he said.
Yes, it is all shocking and childish and immature and petulant and cruel. I mean, John McCain is dying. But he's been doing this for years. There's nothing new here. There's nothing new in him calling Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas. There's nothing new in him attacking John McCain. Nothing new in him attacking the Bushes. And yet, whenever Donald Trump wants to change a subject, he just sets up a rally and then goes and says a bunch of crazy stuff. And I do wonder at this point what information is being encoded in that.
Well, his mockery of the Me Too movement, that was new at the rally on Thursday night.
What? Donald Trump's existence is a mockery of the Me Too movement. The fact that he has given rise to a joke, I don't really agree. Like, I don't agree this is new. I'm not attacking, by the way, CNN. Vox covers this too. I cover it. I tweet about it. I want to be super clear here. I am not outside the machine looking in and criticizing
it. Yeah, I understand.
I'm inside the machine looking out and wondering what the hell we're all doing. So, like, I do want to ask the question. One, what are we crowding out when we give these rallies, when we let him decide what we cover every time he does a rally? Right? What are we crowding out? What would have happened in another administration? How long of a story would Scott Pruitt have been?
Right.
How long of a story would Bill Shine have been?
And I'm part of the problem, I think, because I wrote a story titled Trump Calls Journalists Bad People at a Rally a Week After a Newsroom Shooting.
I'm actually a little more sympathetic to that specific story.
So I think the argument there is that we need to point out when he's using dangerous rhetoric in the wake of a tragedy. But I, you know, through his sheer force of talking, right, through the volume of what he says at rallies, it's true he generates dozens of stories that do crowd out other important issues.
No, I want to be super careful there because this is a thing I think we do in the media. We put the verbs on him and not on us through his sheer force of talking. Like Donald Trump is Black Bolt in Marvel Comics, and every time he opens his mouth, buildings shatter. That isn't how this works. Through our decisions about what to cover, through our outrage at what he is saying, through our belief about what our audience is going to click on, we make these decisions. Look, I am a week and a half back from book leave. I was Oceanside in California, and I was pretty far away from all this for a little while I was trying to think about other things in politics. And it's a pretty amazing experience for me. I mean, I've not stepped out of the news cycle for more than 2 weeks in 15 years. The experience of not having it swirling around me was, I found, a pretty profound one. And the experience of coming back, I've been trying to think about how to explain it to people. The experience of coming back is having somebody shouting in your ear all the time. Like having Donald Trump follow you around on Twitter and on the news and everywhere and say, like, look at this thing I've did. Look at it. And you think, oh, that's terrible. Like, why did you do that? I was trying to work on this thing about the economy. But yeah, that and then he's like, look at this other one. And it's up to us to decide whether to look. But it is our choice, right? We chose not to cover these things when other presidents did them, these kinds of speeches and rallies in the same way, because we found them boring. We don't find Trump's thing boring. He activates something visceral and human in us, right? It's not boring. I always say that the way Donald Trump behaves would make you worried if it was behavior that you saw in your spouse or your employee or your friend or your neighbor.
But that's why it
speaks
to
something
very
normal.
Ezra. I don't agree. Covered.
Not after it stops giving us valuable information.
Listen to the rest of my debate with Ezra on our Reliable Sources podcast. You can find it through Stitcher, TuneIn, or Apple. And we'll see you right back here this time next week for more Reliable Sources.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.